have been objections to my plan. I know that the scientists have found microscopic creatures living within the ice particles. But I am certain that we can mine the rings without unduly harming these microbes. The rings are huge, vast, and our mining operations would hardly scratch them. Spreading his arms as if in supplication, Eberle said, "We can grow wealthy, and the wealth we generate will support population growth. When the time comes, we can build new habitats, new centers of human society that can grow and spread across the solar system, or even out toward the stars themselves. The future is in our hands. We don't have to fear runaway growth or a static, brutal police state. We can be the progenitor of new worlds, worlds that we build with our own hands, our own minds, our own hearts."
Holly thought she could hear the applause from every household in Habitat Goddard.
Estella Yanez watched Eberle on the wall screen of her living room with narrowed eyes. Turning to her husband, sitting on the sofa beside her, she asked, "Is he right? Can they mine the rings without destroying the creatures living there?" Yanez shrugged elaborately. "Estella, my dear, he is the chief administrator. He has access to much more information on the subject than we do." The screen now showed Berkowitz, who was explaining that the candidates would now take questions phoned in from the viewing audience.
"But do you believe him?"
"Why should I not believe him? Do you think he would lie about something so important?" Estella pursed her lips.
"I have seen politicians lie before."
"Wait," Yanez held up a hand. "Listen. Someone is asking the same question." The screen showed Eberle again, sitting behind the table and smiling benignly. "Yes," he was saying, "I know that the scientists want to declare the rings off-limits for mining. But don't you think that's an overreaction on their part? After all, the rings contain more than 500,000 million million tons of water ice. And how much will we be taking away from that staggering amount? A pittance. A millionth of a percent at most." The caller's voice insisted, "Yes, but won't even a small amount kill off the creatures living in the ice?" Eberle's smile grew tolerant. "My friend, people have been mining the metals and minerals on Earth for thousands of years. Have they killed off the microscopic bugs that live in those rocks? No, not at all." Yanez turned to his wife. "There, you see?"
As the two-hour-long debate wound to its conclusion, Holly felt drained, defeated. Eberle had deflected the ZPG issue and turned it into a reinforcement for his scheme to mine the rings. When she'd asked him what he'd do when the IAA forbade mining, he'd smiled and said that he was certain he could negotiate the matter. "This doesn't have to be an either-or confrontation," Eberle said. "I'm certain that, with patience and goodwill on both sides, we can work out a compromise that will allow us to mine the rings and still allow the scientists to study their bugs." Before Holly could rebut, Eberle added, "There's no need for hysteria or scare tactics." Holly had no response for that. A caller brought up the power outages that still afflicted the habitat sporadically. Eberle smoothly replied, "Our engineers and computer people have determined that the problem is coming from surges in Saturn's electromagnetic field. They've figured out how to predict the surges, and we're now setting up protective systems that will eliminate the outages within a few weeks." Eberle then winked outrageously for the cameras. "The problem will be solved by Election Day, I promise you." All the calls seemed to be for Eberle. Of course, Holly realized. He's planted these callers. His people are swamping the phone lines. "How do we know," a man asked, "that there's really a market for water from the rings?" Beaming as if he'd been waiting for this one all evening, Eberle answered, "You know, I asked myself that very question a few weeks ago. Are we fooling ourselves by assuming that the settlements on the moon and the asteroid belt and elsewhere will buy water ice from us?" He hesitated a dramatic moment, then proceeded. So I called the leaders of Cellini and Ceres. They've assured me that they'll buy water from us, and at a price that will give us a 20% profit margin. Holly knew there was no way she could beat this man. No way at all.
2 May, 2096, Nanolab. Yes, Chris Cardenas said to Urbain's image on her wall screen. Given these specs, we can generate nanomachines that will build a new antenna system on Alpha. Urbain appeared to be seated at the desk in his office. There were dark rings under his eyes, and his face seemed thinner, more lined than Cardenas remembered it from earlier meetings. She was no physician, but it looked to her as if the chief scientist was under tremendous stress. He nodded somberly. Good. Can you proceed to build the devices at once? Cardenas nodded back at him. I'll give it my highest priority. How soon will they be done? Calculating mentally and adding a generous safety factor, Cardenas said, In 10 days. A week, if everything goes smoothly. Urbain sighed as if he were about to sign a pact in blood. Very well, then. Please proceed as quickly as you can. Fine, Cardenas said. But once we've produced the nanos for you, how are you going to get them to your machine down on Titan's surface? Urbain didn't answer. He had already broken the phone connection before Cardenas finished her question. The wall went back to displaying one of her favorite paintings, an impressionist street scene from 19th-century Paris. Swiveling her chair, she looked out across the nanotechnology lab from the alcove that she used as her office. Tavallaro was just coming in through the airlock door. Sorry I'm late, he called, as he walked past the workbenches toward her. I had breakfast with Timoshenko, and we got to talking about beefing up the protection on the superconductor shielding. Cardenas got up from her chair, thinking, we're getting popular. It's taken a year for people to get over their fear of nanos and come to us for help. Now Timoshenko wants us, and Urbain has finally decided to let us help him. The question popped into her mind again. How will Urbain get our nanos to his machine on Titan's surface? I need some advice, Tavallaro said. He looked distressed, embarrassed. Cardenas smiled at him. It's easy to get advice, Raoul. She gestured to the wheeled chair beside her desk, and they both sat down. What's the problem? There's a ship coming from Earth, with a contingent of scientists to look at Wonderly's bugs, Cardenas said. Nadia's planning to go back to Earth with them. Tavallaro nodded somberly. I could hitch a ride home with them. Cardenas understood. Is that what you want to do? Maybe. I don't know. She studied his long, gloomy face. You'd like Holly to come with you, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
It came out as a long, sorrowful groan.
But I know she won't.
Raoul, she can't. She's running for election.
I know.
She can't leave the habitat, even if she wanted to.
Which she doesn't.
Cardenas thought for a moment. What do you want to do, Raoul? He looked away from her, studied his shoes.
I want to go back home, he muttered, without lifting his face.
Cardenas waited, and sure enough he added,
And I want Holly to come with me.
You can't have both.
I know. But you asked me what I want. That's what I want.
She hesitated, then decided to plunge ahead. Have you asked Holly what she wants? Still looking down, Tavallaro replied,
She wants to be chief administrator of this place. She'll never go back to Earth.
Has she told you that?
I know she won't.
Have you asked her? Tavallaro shook his head.
What good would it do?
I don't know, Raoul. But at the very least, you should talk this over with her. The sour expression on his face showed what he thought of the idea.
Yeah, he said. Right.
Timoshenko was coasting along the outer hull of Habitat Goddard, unencumbered by a spacesuit. The virtual reality program allowed him to see what the maintenance robot saw, feel whatever it touched with its pair.